The Brothers Wisp.
Now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp, number 114. Today we have the venerable Mike Hammett with us from Chicagoland.
How's it going?
Hey. See, you're wearing your colors there. What's the story there?
I have a very complicated clothes selection policy. It's the shirt on the top is the shirt that I wear. I've been a bit disorganized lately, so I worked through. So like, I have one drawer that's like sports type stuff. Whether it's for Chicago teams or the local university. And then another drawer that's mostly tech stuff, you know, shirts I've gotten from conferences or vendors or whatnot. And I worked my way through all of the tech shirts. And so earlier this week, I started wearing my sports shirts. So I've worn a different Cub shirt probably every day this week.
You know, it's funny. Since I started working from home, I always wear my black undershirts. Like on work days. So the idea being, if I had to actually go in, I could just grab one of my button-up shirts, throw it on, and go and do the thing. And so that's kind of like become my work outfit. And I've noticed that the weekend's the only time I wear a shirt with any color. That's why I've got this red one on right now. For you folks listening, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But I've noticed that my wife is using that as her calendar. So, you know, on the odd days I show up with color, she's like, "Oh, it's the weekend. All right." So she's doing that thing where she's losing track of everything. Somehow my wardrobe is keeping her on task. It's great. It's good. Keep her in the know. All right, let's get some of the good stuff out of the way. So we have some new patrons to go through, and I think I'm going to be able to pronounce these. We have Matt IGGO, so I'm going to say Igo. Igo? Matt. Matt I.
Matt.
Then we have Taylor Coomer and Kit Santano. So welcome to you guys, patrons. You go to patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp. You throw us a couple of bones, you become a patron. So that helps support the podcast and also gets you access to our patron only exclusive Slack channel, where a lot of this material actually derives from, as well as good conversation. There's good camaraderie. I've heard somebody say that, in their area, they're kind of rural, where, believe it or not, a lot of the people listening to this are going to be in rural areas. And they said that they didn't really have any folks to bounce ideas off of. Nobody really, I guess, that they would consider, in the same industry or near their same skill level or whatever. And so this provides a place for them to find that. So I thought that was pretty cool. So we also have some sponsors. Today we have our Sonar.software sponsor, the longest, most dedicated sponsor we've had, and they are a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. So you're a WISP, you need to bill your customers and have all that done automatically. When they don't bill, you need them cut off. That's the kind of thing Sonar.software takes care of for you. So pop on over and give them a look. We are also sponsored today by Cambium. They are still doing their EPMP bundle, and we'll put a link in the show notes in the descriptions down there. And in this bundle, they have a discount. So it's technically a $6,000 value, but you're getting it for right under $2,000. You get not only that discount, but you get RF elements twist horns. You get 2 hours of one-on-one with an EPMP engineer. You also get 6 months of VSPOTNet automating and billing, as well as a CN Heat trial. So pop on over to Cambium via that link and have a look-see. Mikey, you ready to rock and roll?
I'm looking at that page for the Cambium promo, and it talks a lot about the kind of stuff that you get. But what I'm most interested in right now is there's a picture of a guy in a beard with a white hard hat and the Cambium logo.
Gotcha. So you're looking at how do you get a beard. I'm not 100% sure how to tell this, Mike, but just stop shaving.
Oh, okay. I know at Cambium, I would like one of those hard hats. I will wear it the next podcast if you send me one.
All right, well, let's make that happen. let's make some contacts. Let's put some people together. Let's make this happen. It's Mike's make a wish. All he wants is a hard hat that says champion. I'm thinking we can manage that, even if we got to sharpie it ourselves. So let's see. Starting off, it's a mixture of my stuff and your stuff. Let's talk about the T-Mobile outage that happened the other day. So I thought it was interesting because there was a little bit of misinformation that was let out ahead of time. And I'm not 100% sure where it came from, but there was a massive T-Mobile outage. Man, it feels like a million years ago at this point. I've lost all track of time. It was last month at some point.
Yeah, I'm guessing from the article, 17th, 18th, something like that. So, like, really only like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, maybe it was on the 16th. No, I think it was on the 16th. There you go. Yeah. So they had a massive outage, and I heard from a couple of different sources that it was a DDoS attack. But come to find out, that's not exactly correct, is it?
It's potentially partially correct. In that, so the official story is that there was a transport circuit that had failed, and then the backup for that circuit failed, and then cascading reactions through the network, putting it under immense stress. And so some of the conversation I had seen about that was suspecting that if the transport circuits went down, stranding, you know, a bunch of towers, when they came back online or they routed around the problem, there was a bunch of, you know, all the handsets were trying to, you know, re-authenticate, you know, reassociate with the network, so on. And I know they have big infrastructure, but it's probably not scaled to handle tens of millions of handsets re-registering at once, and thus then overloading the back end. I don't remember where I saw that, so I can't say how accurate that may be or how reliable that may be, but, you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, if you've got a WISP and you have like a centralized PPPoE server and you reboot it, and you got 5,000 subs trying to reestablish PPPoE, it's not going to happen anytime soon for all of them.
Right. That actually makes me think of another thing that I had on the list that came up within the last 2 weeks or so, give or take, is that somebody was saying, hey, I'm an ISP and I've got two upstreams, right? So, and it generally load balances just fine on those upstreams. But what happens is whenever X upstream goes down, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, CenturyLink. When CenturyLink goes down, my failover to whatever the other one happens to be, it gets super congested and everybody's having a bad time. What do you guys do in that scenario? So what would be your, and I've actually been in this scenario before, so I'm just curious to see what your go-to would be in that.
Mine would be, well, there's two ways of handling it.
Oh, there's more either, than that. Come on.
Well, I mean, there's two major ways. Throwing capacity at it or throwing quality of service at it. You know, those are the two major ways. And depending on where you are, would kind of dictate which one of those is more viable. If you're in sub-Saharan Africa or Alaska, Alaska, there's only two providers. So if one goes down, you can't buy it from somebody else. And bandwidth is absurdly expensive. So you're going to want to do some quality of service. But for me, what I would do is I would increase my bandwidth, but I would actually do so via a third provider, via a tertiary diverse route and pop, and so that there would be no chance it would go down. You know, if I have a link going southeast and a link going northeast out of my network to two different pops, I'd have a link from a different pop that goes west, you know, just completely so that I know that it's actually going to stay there.
Yeah. I think the key word you said there was diverse. So in a lot of areas, especially the folks listening to this, they're going to be in rural areas. They probably aren't going to have a lot of options as far as fiber providers coming in and out of the area, right? So thinking, oh, I'll just buy another transport circuit from, say, CenturyLink when they're already one of my providers. I'll be getting DIA from somebody else, right? So I should be safe, right? In my experience, most of the outages that I run into are due to fiber cuts. So if that transport provider, you know, is bringing you DIA for the CenturyLink and they're transporting you over to somewhere else and they get a cut, I mean, you're dead in the water. You're back in the same boat. So if you don't have diversity there, then sometimes you got to build it or see what else you can. I mean, it's just, you know, and it's like come up with a different solution because the idea of a third provider, if you've only got two fiber sources, to me, that's there is no diversity there. I look at them as one and the same.
But yeah, it's and, you know, and I think that's where WISPs have it easier than most other types of network operators, is in it's fairly trivial for us to extend our network, you know, 60 miles somewhere else. Right. You know, throw up, you know, two relay towers in the middle, you know, and you can do, you know, 20 miles, 20 miles, 20 miles, bam, you know, now you're at 60 and you've at least cut out your last mile and potentially first hop, even if it's on the same infrastructure. But hopefully over 60 miles, you've been able to come across somebody else.
Yeah. Well, I'd say even then, whoever that somebody else is, get a route map of where their fiber's going, because I've used, for example, FiberLight before. So FiberLight from College Station to Dallas, they go up six to, so it's basically they go from Houston through College Station to Waco, and then from Waco they go up north to Dallas. That's the route they take. But somewhere between just before Waco, I think, or at Waco before they get to Dallas, they actually kick over to some long-term lease fiber from Windstream, right? And they don't generally tell you that, but say for example Windstream's one of your providers inside of your network, you know. We've had it before where Windstream had a cut and it's taken like 16 hours to get a repair on that fiber, right? So if they're your DIA and somehow they happen to be transport from a different provider, then you know what I mean? So you really, and most of the providers, I've never had any problems with them giving me the route paths and telling me who owns all the pieces, you know, along the way. You might have to sign an NDA, but you know, that's a small price to pay. It's not costing you anything.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's, you know, I make sure that I get a KMZ of the exact route that I'm carrying or, you know, buying. And then I can, you know, load that into my GIS tools. And, you know, obviously they could send me bad data and I have no way of knowing that.
Right.
But, you know, I can load that up into, you know, I mean, I would load it into ArcMap, but you know, most people could load it into, you know, say Google Earth.
Yeah, that's what I always do.
Get to, and it's, you know, if one KMZ comes at all close to the other KMZ, you know, even if it's in the same town, okay, you know, now let's get more serious. You know, let's go determine where this infrastructure really is, because the maps are probably wrong. You know, it's probably not down. You know, if they're going down the same street. And one shows the left side, one shows the right side. No, they're probably both on the right side and in the same cable. So, you know, if they even come to the same town, you know, circle back to both providers and, okay, you know, I need to make sure that in this town that your data is correct, because my other route is there as well.
For sure. Well, earlier, well, let's put a pin in this one. So in my scenario, in this, when I was trapped in this two provider scenario, I did the QoS route. It wasn't in the budget to get more bandwidth or to get a third provider. So we were stuck, right? And I think a lot of folks find themselves in that situation, or say, for example, they have one of the providers they want to dump, but they're still trapped in a contract. So they're waiting for that one to expire so that they can you know, like, so they're lining up dominoes and they just can't do anything about it now. So, I mean, there's a number of scenarios. And nowadays, you know, with the falling prices of bandwidth and all that stuff. Yeah, but again, you said, you know, some areas it's a little bit more scarce. So you're, you know, you're stuck with what you get, you know, and you don't throw a fit. But in my situation, I did quality of service. So I basically prioritized business customers over your residential customers. And we had kind of a red panic button that we would hit, and it would throw queues on all of the MikroTik routers for like the apartment complexes. So it would just squeeze those guys down. So it definitely wasn't a happy solution, because we got a lot of calls from people angry about, you know, hey, I can't get to Call of Duty right now, or you know, whatever it happens to be. But those guys were dropping the bucket compared to what our customers, our business customers had. And also, generally, your business customers are going to have tighter SLAs, right? Their contracts are going to be written in such a way that there's a lot more pain on your part for violation of said rate limits and things like that. So to me, it's triage, right? Those triage scenarios. What's the lesser of evils? And for us, it was squeeze some of the residential guys for the whatever, 4 hours, 6 hours, sometimes 8 hours that it would take to do a repair. I'm not saying it didn't take like 12 hours before. I mean, sometimes it takes a really long time, right? If there's inclement weather and things are just really, like if there's flooding and somebody hits a pole, well, guess what? You're going to be waiting a while. You know what I mean? But
sure.
You do what you do. And then, you know, Band-Aids like that generally can buy you enough time to get where you need to be, right?
And then like something else to keep in mind in the QoS aspect is that you need to make sure that you have router CPU capacity to handle it. You know, if you're already running at 50% doing no QoS, you know, you're SOL no matter what you do, because you put on QoS and it's going to be crap performance anyway.
Yeah, yeah. At a really high volume, right? Yeah, because that queuing, that's all having to be tracked by the CPU. It's having to see what's going on. You know, if we're talking about MikroTik infrastructure, right, it's the whole part that's having to keep track of all of that stuff and then maintain the, you know, how many bits are in the buckets and the queues and how much stuff gets to move through. So, yeah, it can take a definite hit. I mean, there's ways around it, right? Like using, you know, if you're if you've got a whole bunch of users and you want to squeeze them down to a certain rate limit, you can use like PCQs, right, which are a little bit more efficient and things like that. It's a little sloppier for sure. You know, you can't be as granular per person sometimes or things like that. But there's let's be honest here. We're talking about a Band-Aid, right? And so with a Band-Aid sometimes, or, you know, duct tape or baling wire or however you want to look at it. Somebody told me one time the most permanent solution is a temporary fix. I found that to be true far too many times for myself and other networks I've helped with. But yeah. Like in a emergency situation, that's what I've done in the past, and it was successful. Not perfect, but successful, I thought.
Sure.
So going back to the original thing we were talking about, the ISPs with it was T-Mobile. T-Mobile had that failure. And then some of the backup pieces were having issues. And I've seen time and time again, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just the city of Houston specifically, but every carrier I've ever used there, whenever they have a primary cut, their backup never has enough capacity to support the load. They always have heavy packet loss, or at least moderate packet loss, enough to where you feel it on your network. I don't know why that is. Maybe people just aren't paying enough attention to Houston. Maybe there's I assume it just comes down to money, right? If there's enough money there, they'll do stuff right. But it seems inevitable. Anytime I had a Comcast business circuit out there, had issues with that. Zayo had issues with them. And I think they had a cut in Austin, and that caused issues.
That's one thing I don't get. It's like, those are all big carriers. Yeah. There is no the cost for them to throw in, you know, another 100 gig wave back to somewhere else is nothing.
Yeah. TW Telecom before they got acquired. Like, literally every carrier I've used there has had a cut, and then their backup wasn't substantial enough to support the load. Like, every single one of them. Cogent had that with Cogent as well. Not so much in Bryan. I mean, it's happened maybe once in Bryan to me before, but most of that stuff's coming out of Dallas, whereas the Houston stuff, it's a crapshoot. I just don't understand it. But you're right. They've got the money, right?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I get they're supposed to be making money, but, like, you know, how much can it really cost? You know, they know where these congested areas are. And if their network is worth anything, you know, there's not many of them. You know, if it's the whole network, then you're going to have crap service all the time, because there's always something being backhoed somewhere. I mean, you know, it just can't cost that much when you have the underlying fiber asset and the underlying DWDM gear. It's just one-time cost, maintenance or support on that card or optic or whatever. But I mean, you know, you're not, you know, there's not a reoccurring cost to pick up a wave somewhere for most of them. Just do it.
Now, granted, the last time I had a cut with capacity issues was probably 5 months ago, and that was on Zayo. So I don't know. I can't say that everybody is still in that same boat, but it wasn't that long ago that I had the last issue with that. So I don't know. It is what it is. So tell me about this box thing, this FiberStore box. I clicked the link, and it's some weird little page hidden behind a wall. I'm just curious, what is this in reference to?
So a FiberStore box is an SFP programmer.
Oh, okay.
And I got one a long time ago and hadn't had a need to reprogram any optics for any reason until yesterday. And actually, let me turn around and get it.
I remember you did something in the Today I Learned section about this thing, right?
Oh, this stupid Skype. So it's just a little box. It's about the size of like those little USB battery packs.
Yeah, it looks about the size of a cell phone, but thicker, yeah. Right? Maybe twice the thickness.
Yeah. And so on this side, I don't know how good the camera's going. There's a USB-C that's your link to your laptop. And then I think it's XFP on that side. It says, I just don't. Yeah. It's XFP interface on that side. Then on this side, we have an SFP or SFP Plus and QSFP Plus or QSFP 28 Plus on that side. And so then you can stick any FiberStore optic in there and choose a different vendor, and away you go. And so I have a bunch of Cisco coded FiberStore optics here, and I put them into my Extreme switch, and you know, I put one in and I changed it to Extreme, and then I put, you know, them both into different ports, and I got all the same information out of both optics, but you know, one said supported and one said unsupported. and so you know, there's you know, obviously different vendors are gonna have different thresholds, and there's different settings you can tweak. I think there's a pro section you can go into to get more specific with what you want the information to say, but I don't have a need to do that right now, so I haven't. But it's like $200, I think it was, for the box. And you know, and then you get to, you know, I don't have to stock a bunch of spares for every brand of thing I work with. I can stock one kind and just make it be whatever I want.
That's cool. So you just grab like one SKU for your gig optics, one SKU for your 10 gig, and basically it becomes whatever you need it to be whenever you need it. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's on my list of things to try is in Chicago, I have some Brocade switches, and apparently that model switch does not support BiDi or does not support DDM information for BiDi optics. So I'm gonna sometime I'm gonna try to see if I can recode those so that they present themselves as a regular optic. So that way the switch then has, you know, has the light levels and stuff.
You think that's gonna work?
I've got spares, so if it doesn't work, I'm not, you know, I can just swap back.
Well, that's cool. I remember at one point they were potentially giving some of those out free, right? So, but you said now they're selling them and they're just right around 300.
I thought it was 200. Okay. But I've had this thing for, I don't know, probably a year, so I don't know what it is now.
Oh, rock and roll. That's still not too bad.
Yeah. Like, you know, I had looked at, you know, what it would, you know, like there's a whole bunch of Raspberry Pi based solutions and you could go in there and tinker with stuff, but it's like $200 and it's going to work and it's supported versus $100 for a Raspberry Pi. And I got to tinker with it and get code and nah, I'll just buy it.
Yeah. Be done with it.
Yep. And it, yeah. It's a 198 ships out of Asia.
Baller, man. Not bad at all. All right, so let's see. What else do we have on the list? I, if you haven't figured out, I started working for Red Hat, so I've been doing a lot of Ansible stuff. So sometimes I'm just doing something to see if I can do it. So I wrote a playbook to back up a router-based Dude install. So I run Dude on a CHR, and I use it for some various different little thingy things. So I have a playbook that goes in there and will back up the Dude install and then FTP it back off, which I hate using FTP, but it is what it is. It's built in. It actually works reliably at this point, so I'm just going to stick with it. I also saw that Zach made a playbook that pulls his backup files into a folder and then like does this diff on them. It's really cool and fancy. He put a lot of work into it. And he's been kind of constantly grooming it. So if you're curious about doing those sorts of things, I would say jump in and take a look at his playbooks. But I tried to one-up him, right? Because I'm big on the one-upsmanship for sure. So I...
and you work there, and that's kind of your job. So
yeah, it's quickly becoming my job. Although nobody that I'm ever going to run into has heard of MikroTik. So it's no worries there. It's mostly Cisco, Juniper, Brocade, Arista, that kind of stuff. But I wrote one that connects to, right now it's only doing three. It's doing Cisco, Arista, and Juniper. I'm going to add MikroTik to it and then other things as I run into them. But it will go to your network devices. It will back up your configuration. But then once it's backed it up to a file on your local machine, it actually pushes that to your Git repo. So the good thing about that is, first, it clones your Git repo that's got all of your backups in there. So it's got the most up-to-date backup files, and then it will replace them with whatever you pull off the machine. If it actually changed, it'll push it, and it'll put the date as the comment on there. If it didn't change, it doesn't.
Oh, nice.
It doesn't do anything. So you can actually go into your Git repo, just scroll down and see when stuff changed. And Ansible, they've got the ability, if something fails, like when it's running a job, so if this backup job fails, you can actually email yourself of everything that worked. And you can do notifications out the wazoo on Git. I mean, there's plenty of that stuff on there. So right now I'm just doing it to GitHub, but you could use any Git compatible. I mean, you could use GitLab or Bitbucket. That's the one. You could use that if you wanted to. And the good thing about that is you can go in there and click, you know, the diff button and show you the visual diffs and all that stuff. So it's a work in progress. I'm going to keep maintaining that one because I think that one will be interesting. So I've seen in some of our customer demonstrations, different folks will say, you know, oh, you can use it for backup, you know, and kind of show how that. And I was thinking that's, you know, it's like, yeah, it's good. But what network engineer really wants to see just files in a folder, right? We've all done that in the past and that's not really usable. So it's thinking, hey, you know, maybe this would be a more interesting way of looking at it. You know, and it's funny because, really, your preferred method of doing automation with Ansible is through Tower, right? Like the GUI thing. And, you know, I was just thinking, you know, everything that you're pulling in from there, you're doing it through SCM, you know, like some software source control management like Git or whatever. So why would you push all this crap to Git as well? So trying to unify all the things I'm learning into one little bucket there. I am no expert by far, but I did an advanced class and it made me feel pretty good about myself because I had already covered most of the things that were in there. Always learn more though, right?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. So what's all this hypervisor stuff you got in here?
Well, I don't know what the second entry is anymore. because I had put these in for the show notes for the last show that we didn't make. And, so it's been a couple of weeks and I don't know what I was going to say for the ones that aren't sourced.
Well, we've got the hypervisor comparison chart, which is nice.
Well, yeah. And so for that one, for one of my hats, we have a common, PC-based virtualized MikroTik router. And we've been running into some performance issues with it. And its primary purpose is just moving data at high speeds, you know, no firewalling, queuing, triple PoE, any of that stuff. It has a basic input firewall rule, but that's it. And so we've been kind of pushing the boundaries to see how we get more performance out of it, because every night for several hours, we get packet loss. At the beginning, it was pretty extensive. It was up to about 17%. We're getting more throughput now than we did before. And I think, and last I checked, we were down to about 2. It's 2 still isn't good. But, you know, it's been going through a whole range of, you know, turning things on and off in MikroTik, you know, reconfiguring things on the VMware side. And I kept going to Facebook and the MikroTik forums asking for help. Who's done, you know, CHR performance tuning for various things. And people kept saying, you know, Hyper-V, 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 you know, you should be using Hyper-V, not VMware. And I was like, okay, well, this router's in production. I'm not going to format the disk to put a new hypervisor on and then rebuild it. And if I'm buying something new, I'm probably not going to buy the same thing I'm having problems with now. So I'll probably buy something different.
Right, right.
So then, you know, somebody then actually said, you know, in Kevin Meyer's presentation he did, he clearly showed that Hyper-V is better. Way, way, way better. I'm like, oh, well, I remember it being way, way better for BGP, but I don't remember it being way, way better for throughput, which is what my problem is. You know, I don't need to be concerned if my BGP feed converges in, you know, 20 seconds versus 35, that's fine. It could take a minute and I'm still fine with it because the router is going to run for months. My issue is routing performance. And so I pulled up his presentation that he did and, you know, opened up Google Sheets and just started pulling the data out of his slides to organize everything, to see how the different operating systems or hypervisors actually performed. And when the rubber hit the road, Hyper-V for throughput was almost 50% worse in performance than VMware. You know, I didn't do any of my own tests. I'm just looking at, you know, tests, you know, information that Kevin Myers had already published. But you kind of put things in perspective, you know, people took from Kevin's presentation that Hyper-V is the best for everything and just moved on. No one paid attention to the throughput differences. And like, you know, at at 1500 byte packets in his particular test, VMware got 5.3 gigs, whereas Hyper-V got 4.4.
Right.
Okay, that's not a, you know, that's not a whole lot of difference, but you go down to 512 byte packets or 96 byte packets, and it is almost a twofold difference. You know, 1.6 gigs compared to 3, or 0.6 gigs compared to 1.1.
And what's interesting too is he has Proxmox on this list at the 1500, the 512, and the 96, and Proxmox on 1500 performs identically with lower CPU, but actually outperforms Hyper-V in the remaining two, which is interesting as well.
Right. Yeah. And so it's, you know, I imagine that, you know, we could test again with updated versions and we'd get different numbers. And I'm sure version 7 is going to be totally different because everything under, you know, supporting it's going to be different. But, you know, while I needed to, you know, verify that I was on the correct platform, which I am, at least per these tests, you know, to me, the most interesting thing was not the technical parts, but the people parts. You know, people just latched onto one thing. You know, it's way faster at BGP. And it is. It's twice as fast.
You know, what's funny is, you know, that you're saying that, that's what was stuck in the back of my mind, too, from that performance test, was that Hyper-V outperformed. I hadn't even realized that the numbers I had heard were about BGP versus anything else.
But yeah, and so, you know, in his tests for the DKIX table load, Hyper-V was 12 seconds, and then Proxmox and vSphere were both 26. So that is over twice as fast on BGP, but, you know, at those low of numbers, I don't care. You know, I don't care how fast it is, because it's not going to be a major issue. Gotcha. And so, ultimately, what we're doing is we are moving all the... Most of the high traffic going through that box works just fine on a very small route table. So we're just going to spin up a Cisco Nexus switch and configure BGP on that and run anything that doesn't have to be full tables through it and just do it all in hardware, wire speed. And then, you know, for anything that needs full tables, you know, we'll just run a VLAN through to the Vengeance and then... you know, manage it there. You know, because we're doing, you know, probably about 12, 13 gigs in, 12, 13 gigs out. And so it'd be nice to move that over to hardware and just not worry about throughput ever again.
Interesting. While we're talking about MikroTik stuff, I had this one higher in the notes, and I thought we had some MikroTik coming up. Pedro was trying to eliminate BPDUs, you know, spanning tree protocol messages going through his MikroTik switch. And for the life of him, he couldn't get it to work. And he realized it's because he had spanning tree turned off and it wouldn't allow him to filter the BPDU. So he actually had to turn it on for the filtering to work, which kind of gave me a little chuckle. So save somebody else some heartache there associated with that. You also have some stuff on the MikroTik RPKI. I know we talked about that with Andrew Thrift a little minute ago. What's new and different on this one?
What I have here is a link to somebody that actually configured it and tested it and trialed it. It's not just, you know, not just talking about what may happen. You know, he actually did it. And so on the link that I sent, you know, he's got, I mean, I haven't done it to see if it really is copy and paste, but it seems like a fairly copy and paste process with a variety of tools to then take advantage of MikroTik RPKI performance. The short version is it works as expected. It works as you would expect it to work. I'd imagine many people expected it to not work because it's Maker Tig version 7. You know, I mean, obviously, it's not an extended test. It's not a long-term test. It's not a complicated test. But doing, you know, just seeing if it worked, and it did. On V4. V6 didn't work because V6 BGP wasn't working. So, obviously, RPKI is not going to be working either.
Right, right. Well, that's cool. There's validation. Somebody's actually put it through its paces, and it's working. So hopefully we can see that, I mean, once, you know, the routing engine really gets up and stable, hopefully we can start seeing that in action. That'd be cool.
It, yeah. And then, you know, I think that'd be real nice, you know, cause there's thousands and thousands of ISPs across the world that are using MikroTik. And it'd be real nice to see, you know, in the global table, just, you know, hopefully hundreds of new networks turn up using it. And for those that aren't quite sure, in a short version, RPKI will help prevent IP hijacks, which plague the internet several times a year. And so this will help make that not a problem. Help make it. You can't guarantee it, but
yeah. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Definitely. I'm not going to hold my breath. I think it's going to take longer than anybody else expects. You know what I mean? We've been waiting on IPv6 to take over the world for quite a while now. So hopefully this will have a little bit more legs.
Sure.
As opposed to that. So you were talking about MikroTik and IPv6. So Pedro, again, man, he was active this last couple of weeks. He had an issue where he had his BGP session up on V6, and it was pointing to the link local address of the next hop router, right? Or rather, I guess the peer. I'm not sure. Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, it was next hop. So he was trying to use that, right? So generally, a lot of dynamic routing protocols, that's what they'll do, is whenever they learn, in BGP's case, NLRI from somebody else, they'll set the next hop to be his link local on IPv6. And it was just killing him. He couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. And he finally rebooted the box, and it re-added his link local address. He had mistakenly gone into IPv6 addresses and deleted his link local that was dynamically created. And it was no longer able to pass that traffic over. So word to the wise, don't arbitrarily delete your link local addresses in V6 if you're trying to do a dynamic routing protocol. And really, you shouldn't delete them at all. So I thought that was kind of another fun gotcha that Pedro found. I wouldn't have even thought to delete my link local addresses, so I don't know that I would have ever run into that one. Because, you know, it's like how do you help somebody troubleshoot something when they do something you would never expect them to do? It's kind of difficult.
Yeah, but then, you know, on the other side of the coin, it's like I totally see, oh, I don't need this in my router. Delete it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, there's been many times I've been looking at some piece of network gear and a really complicated network config, and I'm going through them like, half these things aren't even being used anymore. Let's just delete all these things that aren't being used so that then when I'm looking at it, it's easier to find the problem. Mm-hmm. So I get it.
I get it too. I've done crazy stuff plenty of times, many times over, and I will continue to do crazy things. I wouldn't be me otherwise. So let's see what else we have coming up. There is very soon, I guess, 23 days, 14 hours, and 25 seconds as of me saying that, is the WISP Virtual Summit is coming up. It's put on by Preseam, supported by WISPA, and it's going to be a bunch of first there's going to be a keynote, and there's going to be some little sessions, and there's some breakout sessions that are going on. So a lot of it should be interesting. I happen to be first day right after the keynote. Looks like 10:30 Eastern. So what is that? That's going to be 9:30 my time. That's pretty comfortable. And I am leading a panel discussion on designing your network for scalable growth, do's and don'ts. So this is kind of the idea of, if I'm getting started, you know, what are kind of some gotchas that we can look for. I think the speakers are going to get about 10 minutes. They're going to have a few slides. They're going to say their piece, and then I'm going to cut them off savagely and then move on to the next guy. And then we'll do a little Q&A at the end. And then once it's all wrapped up, we're going to be in a chat room of some sort. I'm not sure exactly yet, but we're going to be in there and ask, or rather answering questions that are asked from the audience, the participants. So there's, what is this thing? It's like 2 days, I think. No, just one day. One day. I was thinking it was 2 days for some reason, but it's one full day, chock-a-block full of, at the end they say break/expo time, which I'm not sure what expo time is for a virtual summit, but we'll see. But yeah, it looks like there should be some interesting stuff in there. So if you're interested, pop in. I think there's a coupon code called The Brothers Wisp, all capital, and it gets you like a discount to this thing. So have a look, see if you're interested. We aren't compensated in any way other than I get to say, hey, come and listen to The Brothers Wisp. So we'll see how that goes. Maybe we'll get some new faces. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm going through the list of speakers, and there's a lot of good people in there.
The Power of Horns featuring RF Elements. Of course, who else would be on that one? But sweet. Yeah, it looks interesting. A lot of it seems to be surrounding your network scaling, whenever you're starting out, once you're at some kind of intermediate point where you're on the fence, you got to figure out, you know, how do I push past and get just a little bit bigger? And then how do I get huge? I mean, that's, yeah, it seems like there's little targets for all kinds of folks, as well as some fiber stuff in there as well. So a little bit for everybody, it seems.
I heard it's not that expensive either.
No, I think it's somewhere around $20, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, so it's worth signing up. I saw on there that all proceeds get donated to WISPA. So being on $25, I think I'm a registered, not use a coupon code, and not care if I even show up because it's $25. You know, I'm not really out anything.
Help the cause. I hear you, brother. All right. Well, I guess the next one we do will be shortly before that, so I guess I'll pump that a little bit more. But moving right along, do you have any thoughts on all this Facebook stuff you're putting up on here, and why should I care about the one that says DeKalb County?
So that one, Facebook is building a data center, a mile from my house. And they've actually closed the road that goes between my house and town. Because it's a 500 acre campus. They bought both sides of the road, so they closed the road.
Oh.
So now it's really annoying to get to town. I mean, like, it only makes like a 2 minute difference, but it's annoying.
I hear you.
I'm trying to get some of the fiber construction business for it. I've been trying for 6 months, but I didn't know who it was. I just knew that somebody was coming. About a week ago, earlier this week, I found out that it's Facebook. And it'd be interesting to see what they do because, obviously someone like that's going to need, you know, multiple dark fiber diverse routes to places. But Facebook's been pretty aggressive as compared to other hyperscale operators in building their own long haul networks. They've built one from, you know, Albuquerque area into Texas. I think it's just to connect to other long haul. But then on the east part of the country, I think they're in the process of building a route from like Ohio down to, like, you know, down past JJ into, I forget if it's North or South Carolina, where they have a bunch of other data centers.
I mean, they're notorious for doing undersea cable as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, almost all of the of the big data center operators called Hyperscale. Those are the people that, you know, have no problem spending billions of dollars on just massive data centers, massive infrastructure for their own use. Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook. Not sure there's really anybody else in that club. You know, they've been building a lot of undersea infrastructure. All four of those companies have been involved with various builds. I think Google's been the most aggressive in that regard. But, you know, none of them have made a lot of noise about their terrestrial fiber builds. But Facebook is, you know, is being very public saying, hey, we're building our own long haul because there's a need that we see. And we had somewhat talked about this a long time ago, because part of their stated goal is they want to make that that route available to ISPs, to, you know, use that fiber network to get to somewhere useful.
Is that where this Lynx thing pops in?
Well, so Lynx is, Lynx is a Facebook program available to currently to US WISPs that are, in a variety of Facebook groups. I think there's three or four WISP-focused Facebook groups. And they have a variety of tools in there about helping you plan to build a WISP, marketing your WISP. You know, some of their goals is, you know, kind of educational, really trying to help reduce some of the barriers to entry to being a WISP, you know, in a non-technical way. I mean, most of us are tech guys and we get that pretty easy, but most of us probably aren't good business people. So, you know, ROI and marketing are a bit of a foreign thing. You know, I was like, okay, well, you know, I don't need to care about this too much because I've been doing this for 15 years. I'm not a startup. But one thing that I saw that was really interesting is in their marketing section, they will let you upload a polygon, assuming KMZ, I don't remember, of your desired marketing area. Before Facebook advertising, you know, you could pick a variety of demographics, but it was when you wanted to pick a geography, it was, you know, choose a town, choose a state, you know, hit a point and type a, you know, how many mile diameter radius. So being able to take your coverage plot that you generated through tower coverage or, you know, yourself or whatever, and just load that into Facebook, say, you know, I want to market here. You know, that's pretty powerful.
Is that what's in it for Facebook? I'm always curious. You know, it's like, where's the money? You know, how are they making money? Is the idea that they make it easy for you to use their marketing engine for people in your area? Is that the idea?
Yeah. You know, looking at, you know, kind of devil's advocate position is, yeah, you know, they are, you know, if they make marketing easier, you will give them more money.
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's the most obvious connection. But, you know, while, you know, Facebook and Google and Microsoft have, you know, had programs for varying years for how to better provide internet to, you know, underserved or unserved areas, you know, some of that is, you know, is giving back to the community, you know, is trying to make the world better. But also all these Google and Facebook, at least, they operate entirely on advertising. So if they can make your internet experience more pleasurable, you'll spend more time doing it and then consume more of their ads.
Right, right.
And so then, not so much anymore of your WISP giving them money, but then people that you serve, you know, if they have a 50 meg internet connection, probably have no problem spending all day flipping through their newsfeed, watching videos, doing whatever, you know, earning Facebook money. If you have a 512K connection, you're going to do the most basic and get out because it sucks.
Yeah, for sure.
But then, you know, talking in, so I got this because I'm an admin of one of the groups, and someone from Facebook messaged all the admins, you know, introducing the program and, you know, soliciting questions. It seems like they really want to know more about how they can do more for us. Now, what they actually do, will, you know, remains to be seen, but, you know, they're soliciting, you know, input on policy. You know, what policy objectives would help WISPs? You know, what technical aspects would help WISPs? You know, in terms of their connectivity and things like that. You know, a big thing for ISPs this year is the FCC's, I don't remember, RDOF grant program, Rural Divide Opportunity Fund or something like that. Where they provide grants to build infrastructure, and they are trying to see how they can help, you know, if we did not apply for that grant program, why not? You know, how could they help us if we would want to? And then if we do want to, again, you know, how can they help us with the process? And so that's, you know, I didn't really care about that for a while until I realized that some of my planned fiber builds are in areas where they are looking at providing money.
Hmm.
So it's like, oh, I mean, like, I've got some fiber right now that's in areas that are, you know, I could apply for, but it's like the maximum I can get, assuming no one else bids, is like 2,000 a year. I'm like, that's not worth the application. But some of the other areas are a bit more, you know, not like, you know, not crazy amounts of money, but enough where it's like, okay, you know, now this is worth learning how this works and filling out an application. And if I'm already planning on doing it, if somebody's going to give me money to do it, then I'll take it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it comes down to how much free time do I have during the day, and do I want to spend that trying to fill out paperwork that's going to have, you know, very small returns. Most of the time, it's probably, if it's not substantial enough, yeah, I'm not going to waste my time.
It, you know, thankfully not my WISP, at my fiber company that I'm working for, you know, there's people that can do this. You know, probably still have to bring in somebody that's a good grant writer, but, you know, there's other people to handle the logistics and whatnot of the application process. Which, if you're interested in applying for that grant program, assuming you're not in my area, go to... I think July 14th is the deadline to indicate that you're interested. It's just a real basic form, from what I understand. You know, it's not saying where you're interested or proving that you're qualified. It's just, you know, put me on the list.
Gotcha. You got 10 days from now, so probably 9 days or 8 days from the time you hear this.
And then, you know, Facebook created a variety of groups to help, you know, manage a lot of this stuff. And so the link will be in the show notes to go to the overall program. And you know, they are pretty good at, giving feedback.
Rock and roll, man. All right, bud. So we are at the hour mark. So I figured we would wrap it up with kind of a thought provoking sort of, question. You know how I like doing those a little bit here and there. I like thinking, I like hypothetical. So I'm going to set it up. So The idea is, I hear it a lot from folks. It's like, how do I design my edge, my core, for maximum flexibility when I'm using a microtech? Should I do this? Should I do that? And everybody's got all these varying opinions. I mean, obviously, everybody's got a different way of doing it. And a lot of that's predicated on what they've done in the past and what's worked for them, right? Whereas the guy next to you might have done the exact same thing, but he did it slightly differently and had success with it. You didn't, so that's not for you. This is how you sort of see things. And quite literally, every person I've ever talked to has a different viewpoint on doing it. Most of the folks that I hear asking these questions generally already have some infrastructure in place. And whatever they're saying, you know, like, how should I? And so I'm looking at this from the viewpoint of, I'm not necessarily having problems now, but I'm trying to head things off the pass. I've heard some various things. You know, should I try and do all of these crazy complicated things? I'm going to go ahead and just say, for me personally, I'm a keep it simple kind of guy, right? So Microtechs, I know we were talking to Andrew Thrift, and he was basically saying folks from New Zealand, they have this this quirk, this personality quirk, where they want to squeeze every ounce of value out of the devices they can. So they love Microtech, and they try and force them to do absolutely everything when you shouldn't always do that. For your example, Mike, how you're having throughput problems on these devices, you know, you're talking about multiple gigs of throughput. Now imagine you're trying to also make that thing NAT, you know, 90% of those connections, and then you're also trying to do quality of service, and so you're going to murder the box. You're not going to get all the performance out of it you need. But in my opinion, most of the people that I'm talking to, if you've got a network and it's operating consistently, reliably, don't sweat it too much. You know, look towards the future. I think it depends on what kind of problems you're running into. You know, is it capacity? Is the router, does it just, you know, CPU wise, is it turning over? You know, are you terminating, like you said earlier, a whole bunch of PPPoE sessions? You know, so sort of look at what you're doing with your devices, and as you, you know, foresee an issue with something, go ahead and make plans to start breaking those pieces out. You know, I think Microtech is an amazing tool. It does lots of things. But like you said, sometimes if you're just trying to move packets and you're not trying to manipulate them, something that's going to do routing and hardware can be a really good choice, right? And even beyond that, to me, I think a lot of devices can actually do NAT in hardware now too, right? A lot of devices can actually. So even some of those pieces that used to be software intensive can now actually be relegated to hardware offload engines and be shown, you know, to get a vast improvement when just moving to different frameworks. But I think for me, sometimes it's really just kind of looking at where are my pain points? Where do I think I'm going to have a pain point? And try and look at maybe solving a problem individually at a time. And I know that's probably not a popular opinion, but if you're only having a problem with one thing, why would you throw everything out the window to try and solve that one problem? Like for me, like when I'm troubleshooting, I try and change one variable at a time, right? It keeps things working and simple. Because I've seen folks try and do a complete overhaul, and you know, it basically craters their network for the better part of a month, and they lose a bunch of customers. They have downtime. In a lot of times, especially in the WISP industry, the way people view you is, you know, 90% of how you actually make your sales, right? Because a lot of that advertising is done mouth to mouth, you know, so, or rather word of mouth, I guess. Not, you're not resuscitating somebody. Yeah, it's word of mouth, right? So a lot of your reputation hinges on that stuff. So what's your, you know, if somebody was to come to you and say, how would you do your edge core? Do you look at the particular issues they're trying to combat? Or do you just say, hey, as a general rule of thumb, this is how you should build your network? I think there's kind of, it seems like a lot of times two schools of thought on that. I'm just curious which one you have.
Sure. And, you know, obviously I would like to learn as much as I can about the problem and the desired solution before making my own recommendations. But a lot of things will be somewhat religious in how you design the network. And they, not even getting into to details, but one really basic thing is, you know, do you centralize all of the work that you're doing, or you distribute it? You know, that's one of the most basic things. You know, do your tower routers route and do the triple PoE and the queues and, you know, whatever, you know, firewalls and, you know, anything else you need done? Are you doing that at towers, or are you doing it at a big box at the core? Because then that really changes how complicated your transport network, how complicated your core edge network have to be. If you're doing all that at the core, you know, the core gets really complicated really fast. You know, you're going to have boxes that are doing triple PoE termination or VPLS termination, and then queues, and then, you know, going through a, you know, pre-seam box to, you know, manage the queues in a better way, and then do this, and then do that. You know, that gets really complicated, and there's a lot more pieces to go wrong. And if you're experimenting with what solution you want to do, it's much harder to test it on a subset of your network before you implement it everywhere, if it's all at the core. I mean, it could be done, but there's not a logical, oh hey, I'm going to try IPv6 on this one tower. No, it's like if you've got, you know, 10,000 VPLS sessions or 10,000 PoE sessions coming back into a central router, or, you know, pair of routers, you're turning IPv6 on for everybody or nobody, pretty much. And so my train of thought is, you know, put that heavy lifting at the tower, and keep the core edge, you know, transport networks simple. Because typically, the simpler it's built, the easier it is to troubleshoot and fix. And if I'm having triple PoE problems, I'd rather deal with it on one tower, not the whole network.
Yeah.
And if I'm having a backhaul problem, I'd rather just know it's a backhaul problem, not is it backhaul or is it VPLS or is it triple PoE or is it something else? Like, it works fine at the router. Okay. Now it's not, now it's just my transport.
Yeah.
You know, backhauls.
And to
routing,
that point,
whatever.
I'm not a fan of all your eggs in one basket either. You know, so I really like distributing that stuff. So, but you know, I mean, that comes back to too. I guess if you have somebody and said, "Hey, I'm about to greenfield build a network. What would you recommend?" I mean, that's pretty straightforward, right? Route at the towers. You know, at your upstream providers, bring one into different routers for redundancy. I mean, so there's like some. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely. I see what you mean there, like with some. So basically, there's like some certain commandments that everybody should follow. Not that they necessarily always do. And there's folks listening on here that have bridge networks that are running just fine. It's just some point you're going to want to do some things that bridge network's not going to really allow you to do. Or if you run into problems, sometimes troubleshooting that bridge network can be such a nightmare. Whereas if you had it routed, you wouldn't run into that problem to begin with. Or if you had it routed, you would, that issue would be relegated to a single tower as opposed to your entire network. Right. So there's definitely, yeah, I know what you mean there. It's just, it's so funny. Like when somebody's already moving in a certain direction and they ask these sorts of questions, it's a tough ask to make on the internet, it seems like. You know, like I'm talking about folks that are like going to a Facebook group and trying to ask a question there, because you're gonna get a million varying opinions, and all of them are very zealous in their beliefs. You know, like you said, it's, yeah, you're arguing your religion, because you know what, and that actually makes a lot of sense, because they've chosen this to be their path forward on their networks, so they have to believe that it's the right decision, right? They can't be any two ways. I didn't make the wrong decision, because if I did, then I'm having to worry about my entire network, and this absolutely works. So maybe that's why they believe it so fervently.
But, and like, you know, a lot of the times in the religious type debates regarding, you know, network design, it's not so much that one is right and one is wrong, because both will get the job done. It's just some are better suited to do X and some are better suited to do Y. Or, you know, and also that, you know, our past haunts all of us. If we had a problem with an unreliable triple PoE server, we're never going to deploy triple PoE again. Yeah. Whether that's right or wrong.
Or a specific vendor. If you had a really bad experience with a vendor, 10 years from now, you'll still say, no, I don't want to use those guys. You know, you've been burned once. Why would you go back to that well? Which makes sense. You know, I try and stay a little bit more open-minded, but.
Oh yeah, I had something really profound and now it's gone.
Somehow I doubt that, Mike. I don't believe you. I never will believe you. No. I think it's a mixed bag when somebody asks for advice like that, because I think you're right. There's a lot of different directions you could go. And I think they're all generally going to get you in the same place. Like you said, X and Y, you know, could be different use cases. And I think even then, at different scales, X and Y could be completely different things too, right? So maybe, on a small scale, like if I'm just lighting up a small neighborhood, maybe layer two everywhere is just fine. You know, maybe who cares? No big deal, right? But if I want to scale that to 5,000 or 10,000 users, Bridge probably isn't the way to go. You know, to be perfectly honest with you.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of moving pieces there, a lot of variables. And it just, I'm not of the mind where I don't like coming in and telling somebody, hey, you're doing it all wrong. This is complete crap. Whenever you're trying to build
unless
something.
It is.
Well, even then, I try and look at the silver linings. because to me, that kind of stuff, that's not constructive behavior, right? That's not very conducive. You don't want to make people feel crappy about themselves. You want to build people up. At least in my experience, I found that to be the best way of working with folks is to build them up. So try and look at the good side of things and find a mutual path forward for them or yourself, whatever situation you find yourself in.
But yeah, and then kind of looking back to when I was saying, you know, figure out what they're already trying, what they've already done and what they're already trying to do. And, you know, even if that's not what you would do, you know, if that's on religion A and you're on religion B, you know, don't try to convert them to religion B. Just figure out, okay, you know, how do I fix what's wrong in your situation in religion A? Because when you totally change everything, now they're dependent on you because that wasn't their idea.
Right.
Well, that's what Greg said to do. So that's what now you don't know anything about the solution. Even if we try to train you or explain things to you, you'll understand something that you did on your own better than something somebody else did. And so if you can just tweak what they've done, change that queue type and you're good versus throw it out and buy per scene. Like, those are two very different things.
So, speaking of that.
And I don't mean to be crapping on per scene any of this. That's
No.
It's a great product.
Yeah, for sure. I've helped install it in a couple of networks now. Where do you get this advice, right? So, in my thinking, you've got a handful of options, right? You could try and talk to your neighbors, but a lot of neighboring WISPs aren't exactly friendly, right? That's your competition. That's the enemy. At least that's how a lot of people see it. Two, you could try and ask in community areas like Facebook or like somebody's forums somewhere, like a vendor's forums, which generally that's not the right place to ask those kind of questions. You're not going to get the answers you want. Or I guess you could maybe call a consultant, something like that. But to me, that's sort of a mixed bag.
Or patreon.com/yourbrotherswisp.
That's what I'm getting at, bud. Give me them dollar bills. I'm going to make it rain. No. But, you know, it's like, to me, that's a community of people that that actually are there to help other people. They're not necessarily keen on pushing their opinions, but they want to share their ideas and things that have worked. So to me, it's like that's an amazing place to go. I'm always skeptical of, well, it's kind of like for me, like if I'm going to go to the doctor, I usually like to have kind of a rough idea of what's wrong with me before I go there. Right? So I can point them in a direction. And I feel like that's a lot of times the same mentality I have when going to a consultant. It's have a rough idea of the direction you want to move in. Maybe even the products you kind of want to use, you know? So that's not practical in all applications. I understand that for all people, but I think it's helpful. I wouldn't suggest going on a vendor forum and asking for design advice. Especially some of them, those environments are a little bit toxic. It's a little bit rough. The Facebook groups, I think there's some good stuff in there, but again, some of those guys are very loud, and some of the loudest voices are oftentimes the most incorrect. So that's sort of tricky too, because like, you know, in an environment like that, if somebody says something that's patently wrong, if somebody else tries to say something, it's going to start like this flame war, right? And so it's like, who do I even listen to at this point? So it's tricky. I just, you know, it's like, if you don't know guys, like, and you have like an environment where you can have those conversations, I don't even know how you'd begin to try and find this information out. Cause you can't just go and buy tons of expensive gear and try and figure it out. You know what I mean? That's not feasible. I don't even know how else you would do it. How about Whisper?
Sure.
I'm sure they have some good resources, right?
Yeah. It's, there's obviously the, WISPA conferences where they have a whole variety of, sessions, from the complete newbie startup. You haven't even bought a router, all the way up to, problems that 10,000 plus customer WISPs face and, things that they manage or, tweaking hypervisor environments and things like, that's getting pretty, detailed, so there's a wide variety of things there, but then they also have some mailing lists, with various topics, and the mailing lists, not on WISPAs because WISPA wasn't around when I started, but that's how I started was, somewhat vendor forums, but mostly on, generic email discussion lists. I lurked for 2 or 3 years just watching what everybody else was talking about before I decided what to do. And, that could be... There are still some of the same drawbacks as the Facebook groups, but it's kind of like one notch more professional. one notch, more experienced people. Now that said, the traffic has gone way down in the mailing list because Facebook is much more convenient.
Right.
So most of the people are doing most of their chatter on Facebook, not on email. Mm. But the lists are still there. There's still traffic. People generally still respond whenever you post something.
All right. Well, good information. All right, bud. We're now 20. Let's take a fork in it. Mikey, if people are out on the internet and they would like to get a hold of you, how would you have them go about doing that?
Don't.
Standard answer.
Although I'm getting closer. We've got glass into our first customer, and I hope to light it sometime in the next couple days.
You're rocking and roll, man.
And I've got somebody else managing a lot of the outside plant stuff now because I can't do everything. And so maybe I'll be able to free that back up a little bit and be willing to give up my contact information.
All right, good deal. Let's hope.
Maybe.
Once upon a day, Mike will eventually have a little free time. All right. Well, if you want to get a hold of me, I'm greg@gregsoul.com, or you go to my blog, gregsoul.com, where I am now regularly blogging again, which feels kind of good, actually, to be putting stuff up every now and then. I'm actually putting more stuff up in my GitHub lately than I have been on my blog. I need to kind of consolidate the two, kind of start linking and writing articles, explaining the things I'm doing over there. But also you can find me in the Little Brothers Wisp Slack. You go to patreon.com/Brothers Wisp. There's a couple bones. I'll send you a link. And in there, I'm really good about answering DMs. I'm actually getting a little bit of my life back. So my training has kind of slowed down a little bit. So I've been able to spend a little bit more time in there as of late, which I'm enjoying to get back in touch with everybody. So thank you guys for listening. Please send any comments, any questions, anything you have like that. If you know of anybody that you would like for us to talk to, I'm always keen to talk to new faces. I enjoy that. If there's any past guests that you really loved, Andrew Thrift, and we all know it, that you would love to see back on, please send us that as well. So I guess thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Up the web and neighborhoods net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.